The documentary work of Ken Burns has been lauded for its excellence for a good many years now, from the Civil War to baseball to jazz and much, much more. He has opened our eyes to history. At his side for many of his productions has been co-director-producer Lynn Novick. The two have collaborated once again for a 10-part series on the Vietnam War. It will air over 18 hours on PBS next month. Ken Burns and Lynn Novick join us by phone to talk about the series. Thank you both so much for being with us.
Thank you.
It's great to talk to you. Great to talk to you again. The last time was right here in the studio.
I remember, in person.
Yes, indeed. Ken, let me start with you. What do you feel, some almost 50 years after the end of the war, needed to be said about Vietnam?
Well, I don't think we've ever said enough about it. It was a war that had an outcome not satisfying to any American, and we tended to ignore it and disguise it and distort it, as we've too often done with moments in our historical past. And there has been, in the intervening years since the war's end, a great deal of scholarship. For this production, we not only were able to take advantage of it, scholarship of every stripe, but we were also able to access extraordinary testimony from more than 50 Americans and nearly 30 Vietnamese, North Vietnamese soldiers and Hanoi civilians and Viet Cong guerrillas, as well as their ARVN counterpart, that's the Army of the Republic of South Vietnam, and their civilians. And so we felt that with the passage of time could come perspective. With the passage of time, you'd be able to triangulate what had happened and help us sort of get out of our hardened silos that have been built up since the war, that's made it even more difficult for us to talk about it and realize there could be more than one truth obtaining at any given time, and to help sort of what's going on now. There is so much division and alienation, a kind of hyper-partisanship, and the seeds of that were sown in Vietnam, and we are unfortunately reaping a pretty tragic harvest right now. And it's our hope that, you know, by unpacking what took place in Vietnam and then repacking it, we can shed our conventional wisdom about it, the superficial knowledge that each of us have, learn a lot of new things, as Lynn and I did in the course of the last 10 years of work on this, but then share the story, as we've done with films on the Civil War and the Second World War called The War.
Lynn, you were born just as this thing was getting started. And so you're obviously very young throughout this entire period. What did you learn? What came to you through your work on this production that may have surprised you, or things that you didn't know?
You know, Ken and I, I'd like to say that pretty much everything surprised us working on this film. For me, I didn't grow up as an adult understanding what was happening. I just knew that there was a terrible war that people were arguing about and very concerned whether we were on the right path and whether we would win, and, you know, was it worth it? All these big questions were being asked as I was growing up. But I didn't really know that much about the complicated story that we ended up telling until we really dove into it with both feet. And Ken and I and our writer Jeff Ward and our producer Sarah Botstein, we all were just humbled every day by what we didn't know. As Ken was just saying, except there's 8 new books and scholars going into Vietnamese archives and American archives. There's presidential audio tapes that we had never heard. There's just testimony, people who lived through it who have thought about this a great deal. It's transformed their lives for good and bad, and they have tremendous inner conflicts about what happened to them and to our country and also in Vietnam. So really every day was a revelation on this project, and it was 10 years of revelations upon revelations.
10 years, and that's an awful long time. It just is almost mind-boggling to think you can spend 10 years on a project like this, but you probably could have spent more.
Oh, absolutely. You know, this is a 10-part, 18-hour documentary series, and that might seem, you know, like a lot. We collected 40 or 50 times that amount in material to sort of be grist for that mill. And you realize that even in a documentary that long, you can't tell by any stretch of the imagination, even a fraction of the stories that you could tell. So you have a Gold Star family that has to stand in for all Gold Star families. You're going to have several Marines whose heroics are going to have to stand in for all the hundreds of thousands of Marines, and same with the Army. And so what we did is we sort of focused on representative and signal individuals whose intersection with the war helps in the totality of all of their recollections to give a sense of the full picture of the war. But people will say, oh, you didn't do this battle, or you didn't cover this general, or you didn't, you know, you weren't here in this province at that moment. And that is true, but we would not tax the attention of our audience any more than we have. And yet, we're incredibly excited to share this because we do think it offers a chance to have a courageous conversation about Vietnam, to maybe bury some of the ghosts from the past, but also to help sort of contain or at least gain some perspective on the demons that seem to be besetting us now.
Yeah, that's an area that I wanted to get into, and let me turn to you with this. Ken has alluded to this a couple of times now, and that is that, you know, the wounds from the war were literal and figurative, of course. How well healed are those wounds, do you sense, from all the people that you've talked to?
You know, we've heard it said that all wars are fought twice on the battlefield and in our memory. And it seemed to us when we started the project and just kept on being reinforced every single person we spoke to that that's very much the case here, that we're still fighting the Vietnam War and how we remember it. And like Ken was saying, we're haunted by these ghosts. And it's the people who lived through it, the second you start to ask them a few questions, we found that they immediately go right back to the place they were then. And the feelings are very strong. And, painful, and there's grief, there's guilt, there's loss, there's anger, there's just a whole combination of sort of a very difficult feelings about what happened and why. And you don't have to talk for anyone very long to find that it's unresolved, it's unsettled, and people are starting to say, okay, why? What happened? We really want to know, you know, the parts of the story that we don't know, so we can put the pieces together, like Ken was saying, sort of repacking it. And, each person that spoke to us, their story is just one piece of it. But in the process of telling their stories, it seemed to us that, you know, on many occasions they could kind of let go a little bit of the weight that they've been carrying, which has been very sort of freeing in some ways.
You know, you look to the streets of our major cities and some that are not so major anymore, and there's still a lot of homeless people out there, and so many of them are Vietnam vets, identified as Vietnam vets.
That's absolutely correct. We've failed in lots of different ways with this chapter of our national life. We think it's the most important event since the Second World War in American history. And I think one of the ways in which that failure is made manifest is how we, you know, treated the soldiers, learned to treat them with respect. The military has a lot of blame. The ways of recruitment and deployment and repatriation was sort of singular, and it felt like everybody came home alone. The war had sort of horrific aspects to it, the way all wars do, but some were particular to Vietnam, and there wasn't a way to sort of, for many of the soldiers, to deal with that. And I think that because it did have this unpleasant outcome and we'd rather ignore it, we've turned our back on a lot of the people who need our help and need our support and need our love. And I hope that at least everyone here will feel that our film is an attempt to sort of permit all the points of view and all the different perspectives to coexist in a kind of civil exchange with one another, despite the controversy of the war itself, besides the horrific carnage that you see. And we hope that we might be part of the solution rather than part of the problem going forward. Another thing I'd like to say is that there are two extraordinarily important figures from Missouri in our film that are a Marine and an Army guy that are hugely important to us being able to communicate the intimacy of this war and the way it affected and touched so-called ordinary people. We both agree that it, particularly in war, but in all of life, there are no such thing as ordinary people. And in the case of this film, I think these are two people from Missouri, along with 77 other people who you'll meet who are extraordinary in their experience Yes.
Can you tell us any more about those two Missourians?
Well, you know, I'd like to be let it be a little bit of a surprise for you. One of them is a Marine from the Independence area, others from the Ozarks in southwestern Missouri. He's in the Army, and they have incredibly different but not at all unalike stories to tell, and I think that they'll be of particular pride to Missourians as they hopefully re-engage with this war and try to make some sense of it, as we've tried to do.
I want to get some other specifics in just a moment, but Lynn, let me come back to you. Throughout this project, throughout the 10 years, and now that the production is completed, do you have any concerns about opening some of those old wounds that we had talked about before? 18 hours is a lot of time, and what I've seen of the trailers and what have you, very dramatic stuff there. It might affect, you know, people. Go ahead.
Yeah, we have been very mindful of the fact that this is some difficult material, but we believe the way we've presented it that the viewers will have a chance to make sense of it and come to terms with it and hopefully find a way to talk about it with each other. We advise people to watch with people you love, because it will be painful for many people who live through it, just remembering some of these times that were so profound in their lives. But there's something very deep and meaningful about human connection in a story that makes sense. And this is such a chaotic event, so we have tried to make sense of it. And everyone who's come to screenings from many different perspectives, different ages, different walks of life, different experiences, have found the experience of watching the film difficult but rewarding. And so we're not worried about it. We're excited about the chance for our country to begin to have the conversation Ken was talking about, and the film can be a catalyst for that. And you know, we think that's going to happen.
One of the things that I've read that sounds particularly interesting is your use of music.
Yeah.
Well, you go ahead, Ken. Why don't you explain how you're doing that?
Well, first of all, I'd like to just add an amen to what Lynn said. And I would submit that this film is, of course, different in every respect. It's about a different event. But those viewers who saw our Civil War series or our series on the Second World War called The War, there are no images, that much more disturbing about Vietnam that should cause pause. I think that it's, in all cases, war is a difficult story to wrangle to the ground. One of the ways that you make a story cohere is with music. Most people, most filmmakers, add music at the end of their process, to boost emotions they hope are already there. We do our music from the beginning, and it's an integral and authentic and equal part of the story we're trying to tell. And, of course, music is, as Wynton Marsalis, the great jazz trumpeter, said, kind of the invisible art. Two notes, and it's already working on you in very special ways. And so we've enjoyed a collaboration with Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross of Nine Inch Nails, Yo-Yo Ma and the Silk Road Ensemble, but we've also been able to supplement their extraordinarily moving, angst-ridden soundtracks with 120 selections from what is one of the most fertile periods of music at any time in human history. And so it is filled with the rock and roll and folk and jazz and country music of the period. And we were able to convince the artist to give us a most favored nation status that permitted us to be able to afford 120 in a normal time. I think 10 would have been a luxury. But the Beatles, Bob Dylan, the Rolling Stones, Led Zeppelin, Merle Haggard's estate, the Jimi Hendrix estate, literally dozens and dozens of the composers of the best music from that period have contributed to the soundtrack, and it is, I don't know of another film that has as dramatic a soundtrack as ours, just by the sheer volume and number of it, I suppose, but also by the exquisite quality. And for someone who did live through that, most of the music in our film is music that I remembered when it first came out, when it debuted, and it triggers associations in me that I'm sure will be the same in viewers of a certain age, of where you were and what you were doing and what you felt and what you wore when they hear these tunes closely associated with the accurate moment that they came out.
Music does have the ability to just force you right back into another time, doesn't it?
Exactly.
Lynn, do you think people will come away from these 18 hours with perhaps different impressions of some of the key players, and those that come to mind right off the top of my head, obviously, would be LBJ, Robert McNamara, Richard Nixon. Do you think people will think of them differently?
That was certainly our experience in working with the material and working with some of the leading scholars on those presidencies, and listening to the audio tapes was just extraordinary. Johnson and Nixon recorded hours and hours, hundreds of hours of conversations, and JFK recorded some private sort of recollections for his own purposes, hopefully for a memoir that he never got to write. But you can hear them speaking in time as events are unfolding with their closest advisors and wrestling with what to do about Vietnam in the context of American politics and civil rights and other things that are happening in the world. And they become, at least for us, I think it's fair to say, human, flawed, complicated, you know, knowable in a different kind of way than we had ever experienced before. It doesn't mean that we absolve them of responsibility for the decisions that they made, but we got a chance to hear them talking it through informally with each other. It was really a window into them, sort of regular people, which we know they're not regular people. These are great men, or, you know, important, powerful men who had enormous weight on their shoulders. But we think that the way we've been able to integrate these recordings in real time gives our audience an insight into our leaders in a completely different way than we've ever had.
Ken, this perhaps is an unfair question, but it comes up a lot in discussions about Vietnam, and JFK was just mentioned. Do you have any feeling, after all the research that you've done, that had John Kennedy lived, that we might not have gotten bogged down in Vietnam the way we did?
You know, these are the irresistible what-ifs of history. You know, we could be thinking and talking this week, what if the Confederacy had won? Or what if the Nazis had won? And these make interesting parlor games and their arguments. And there are dozens and dozens, literally, Don, that swirl around any serious consideration of the Vietnam War. But they are just that. Arguments. They're not the facts. We're charged with what actually happened. So for the person who says, well, if they'd replaced Westmoreland with Creighton W. Abrams, we would have won the war, you just can just shrug your shoulders and go, maybe, but that's not what happened. And with the case of Kennedy, I think it is an extraordinarily interesting thing to consider, but there are lots of mitigating evidence on each side that sort of really, and you end up shrugging your shoulders and saying it's complicated. You know, LBJ took every single one of Kennedy's foreign policy folks, from Dean Rusk at State and Robert McNamara at Defense, all the way down the line, and said to them, I need you perhaps more than he needed you, meaning that LBJ wanted to focus on domestic stuff. He wanted to be another FDR, like his mentor, his hero FDR. So you could make one argument that it's those people and Johnson that went through. At the same time, you know, we've seen even in the short, brief span of Kennedy's presidency that he was able to have huge realizations and make different turns. You know, he was very tardy on civil rights, but when he got it, he got it and would pushing something. Not that he would have been able to get it through necessarily. LBJ could get it through. So there, what happens is that finally you just kind of have to lay down all of those wonderful parlor games and say, but this is what happened. And these arguments are just that, arguments. You know, that if you'd pulled that pitcher before he gave up that home run thing, we would have won the World Series. Well, maybe, but in fact, you lost the World Series.
We have a couple of callers. I want to get into the conversation, but I have one question before we do that. Lynn, I'll throw it your way.
Okay.
Of course, a big part of the Vietnam War story was the protests here in this country. I'm just curious as to whether you see anything today as powerful as, or potentially as powerful as those protests 50 years ago.
Well, I think in looking at the Vietnam War, it was, for those of us who were a little bit too young to have really understood it as it was happening as adults, to see the imagery and to hear people speak about what it meant to them to question government policies, to actually take to the streets and, you know, protest or actually refuse induction or to, you know, take a stand about a big public policy like that. that was unprecedented in the middle of a war, and it's quite something to see the imagery and to hear the discussions about it then and now. And it was a time when our country had to really wrestle with what does it mean to be a citizen in this democracy, and what are the obligations of ordinary people, and what are the obligations of our leaders to us, and what does it mean to be a patriot? And these are the questions that really came to the fore in a way that hadn't been the case in our society in a long time. And they're still with us. So the resonances with what's happening today and the obligation of people to be fully engaged with our democracy are visceral. It's hard not to see what's happening today and think about what happened then.
Sure. And people today are perhaps learning that protests can work. Let's take a call. Go ahead, Lynn. Go ahead.
No, that's okay. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. I wanted to bring a caller or two into the conversation in the time that's left. And we'll start with Sarah, who's calling from Kirkwood. Sarah, thank you for being with us. Go ahead.
Hi, thank you. Ken Burns, it's an honor to speak with you. You are amazing, and I love everything you do. So thank you for bringing this out, and thank you for the Vietnam War. As someone who was born at the end of the Vietnam War, we never learned about it in history in any of my classes, and that my only memory of it is at a parade when I was 12, when all the soldiers walked by as a Memorial Day parade. They started World War One and went down the line, and when they got to the Vietnam soldiers, everyone stood up and cheered, where they didn't stand up and really cheer like they did for Vietnam guys. And I asked my mom, I said, why did they do that? Why are they cheering louder for them? My mom says, because the way they were treated. And that's all I know of it. And having you bring this out and really teach a whole generation or two who just don't know enough about it and get it out there, it's so important. So thank you so much for doing that.
Oh, that's very, very kind of you to say that. Yes, I think if you know, there are a lot of lessons that were kind of learned, maybe learned and then forgotten. But the one important lesson we learned from the Vietnam War that I don't think we'll forget is let's not blame the soldiers anymore. And what I think you were seeing at that parade was just the full-throated sort of a gut reaction of just everyday American folks realizing that for a while, you know, not having perhaps the courage or the understanding or the perspective to hold accountable the policymakers and others, that the soldiers were for some a convenient target. And that ended pretty soon. Some soldiers have stories and don't think it ended that soon. But early on, the anti-war movement understood that they wanted to bring the GIs home and wanted them safe and began to listen to them and their stories. And they became those soldiers who came back and turned against the war, often became the most passionate and articulate advocates of why we shouldn't be there. So I think what your memory represents is this glimpse of daylight that all of us now have towards dealing with the Vietnam War, that here in that gesture that you recall is our possibility in this moment to remember, as Lincoln said in his first inaugural, that we must not be enemies but friends. Though passion may have strained, it must not break our bonds of affection.
We only have 2 minutes left. I want to get Dominic in because his question or comment is related to what we're just talking about. Dominic, come on in, but make it quick, please. Time is running away.
Ken, thank you very much for all of your work. I really appreciate this effort. I wanted to ask you, speaking of this subject, was there any evidence of, quote-unquote, the peaceful hippies spitting on the troops? Or, you know, did you run across any of that in your research? Because I've heard it all along. Let
me stop you there, Dominic, because of time. Ken, can you respond to that?
Well, I'll let Lynn respond because I just took the last one.
All right.
Okay. Well, I think the bigger question, it's impossible to prove a negative whether troops were or weren't put on. I think the most important question is that many soldiers, like Ken was saying, felt that they were not being treated right and in many cases weren't and were called names and were harassed and were not treated with respect and were looked askance and not welcomed properly at all. And that's hugely traumatic. One of the veterans in the film says that coming home from Vietnam was almost as traumatic for him as the war itself, for the reasons that we're talking about. And so, you know, some soldiers say they were spit on, and we certainly would never contradict a soldier for saying that. There's no footage of it, say, but it doesn't matter. The larger question is what Ken was just saying, which is that we as a country learned the hard way that that was not the right way to treat our soldiers. And we will never do that again.
I'll have to stop it there. I'm afraid time's gotten away. And remind folks that the 10-part series begins to air on September 17th at the 9 Network of Public Media here in St. Louis. And also, Lynn and Ken are going to be in St. Louis on the 9th of September at 1 o'clock at the Two Hill Performing Arts Center on the UMSL campus. They'll be talking, just as we've been talking here, about the documentary film, The Vietnam War. And also with them is Gerald Early, someone who is familiar to us here, certainly, and certainly those who have watched the Ken Burns documentaries over the years. He's been a featured part in many of them. I want to thank you both, Ken and Lynn, for being with us. Good luck with your premiere. I'm sure you're going to have a huge, huge audience. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Don, so much.
Thank
it's great
you
to
very
talk
much.
With you.
Right. Thanks.
St. Louis on the Air is produced by Mary Edwards, Alex Hoyer, and Kelly Moffitt, with production assistance from Aaron Dorr, Monica Ramirez, and Spencer Reed. Executive producer is Robert Peterson. It's a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thank you for listening. I'm Don Marsh.